Hey, good morning. This is John Moeller again, and for those of you online as well as here in the room, we're going to get started with the second half of the morning's presentation. Start off with Dahlia Bronco talking about building ontology for the national map. Then Nancy Wiegand will talk about the National Science Foundation project, INROP, and close out with Christoph and Todd talking about space, time, and a few other things in a demo. And we'll turn it over to Dahlia.
Thank you, John. I'd like to, before I introduce my colleagues on our team, our project team, I want you to thank the community of practice, not only for inviting us to give a presentation, but for your congenial colleagueship on this road to progress. The two team members who really did the backbone of the work are sitting at the back. That's Andrew Buden and John Carter. So if you have technical questions, they can probably answer them. I'm sure they can answer them much better than I can. All right. Topographic data is the representation of the landscape around us as we move through the world. Clearly, the world is much richer in information than what we have had represented on topographic maps or by the digital data. The objective of our research on using semantic technology for the national map is to identify capabilities that would benefit users of the 21st century version of the National Topographic Mapping Program. Specific application topics that they're examining for a semantic version of the national map are in geographic information extraction and in data interoperability. Specific tasks we've approached with approaches up to now are designing algorithms for topographic data handling, converting the topographic data and determining spatial relations for tables, developing concepts, taxonomies, logical axioms for topographic ontology, and building the necessary servers and related systems for processing. The sections of this presentation follow the headings of our project work, triple stellations and complex feature ontologies. We welcome your questions and comments at the end or actually at any time during the presentation. Our data conversion procedures quickly face questions of data volume and building geospatial geometries for specific features. We began with the National Geographic Names Information System, the GNIS Gazetteer. We converted sample data sets of four vector data themes from the national map. Those are hydrography, structures, transportation, and divisions, political divisions. Some particular challenges were retrieving data from proprietary formats, determining a method for representing coordinates, being able to expand the range of semantic properties of data by improving the usability of the data for others. We wanted to interlink the data with a larger semantic community by following established conventions, such as the linked data guidelines. Data files were too large to process at workstations. One sample data area, Atlanta, has taken over 2 weeks to determine spatial relations. So the problem suggests the need for parallelization. A preliminary automated approach used the first column in each database row as the subject and each other column header as a predicate and column value as string literal objects. This approach successfully converted the data but not richly enough to take advantage of existing relationships within the data. Vector data files could be isomorphically represented by the geography markup language, GML. To preserve a vector data in queryable form in RDF, the entire feature member string, that is the GML representation of a single entity, for instance, a line or area, as well as its attribute data, is stored and the attribute data are extracted and converted to RDF. This approach allows the vector data to be queried normally while still allowing GML representations of the result set to be combined into a valid GML document, able to be processed and displayed using any GIS software. The only major trade-off to be expected using this setup is an increase in required storage space. The unparallelized data is on the order of n squared, and optimally parallelized is on the order of n squared over p. There are a few unparallelizable parts, like input-output, but on large data sets, the parts are insignificant. Literal values from the database representing other resources are represented using a reference to the URI of the resource, linking the data through RDF to the current feature. The approach maintains the ability to work with data in the original format, but the data can be accessed through open source libraries and programs or recompiled into proprietary GIS formats when necessary. Queries and accessing the database became much simpler, not requiring a username or password to access the server or as much processing to validate a query. Even if semantic attributes in established GIS and geospatial data technologies are attached to the data files, these properties are not easily shared between data sets. These technical limitations have prevented the easy sharing of attributes between data. Previously accessible data remains available while adding new features easily and securely. Opportunities to enhance the data are increased. The converted data acquired increased data richness, making information available that had to previously be computed. The data allowed more complex data classification and relationships than are easily possible in traditional databases. And will be able to scale to large sizes and will be easy and secure to use. This endpoint is available for public access on a joint USGS Missouri University of Science and Technology server. We will be upgrading the server in a month or two. Building a vocabulary of spatial relation predicates and programming the logical reasoning is a major challenge for topographic data. Current GIS attributes are an asset for building a vocabulary. Relations to logical and topographic modeling must be defined, logically formalized, programmed, and articulated to users. Data for which relations can be defined are able to be queried more simply and return data of increased consistency. There is a wealth of predicate terms available in the current USGS data models, though not all of them reflect spatial relations. The USGS supports OGC standards for spatial relation terms, and this work is in progress, but we expect that topologically based terms will be too general for a wide range of topographic science modeling. We are applying a technique that has been tested in other studies, namely to extract spatial relation predicates from feature glossary definitions. We used 668 definitions from three standard sets, the digital line graph data sets, the spatial data transfer system, and the GeoNames feature type definitions. We are classifying these verb and spatial preposition pairs into spatial reference systems that are used cognitively and linguistically by diverse users in diverse contexts. This table on the slide is an example of our work and shows four verb preposition pairs that we identified through this method: flow, caused, form, and removed. Another important function of verb preposition pairs is that they reflect feature type primitives, or those feature components that are necessary and sufficient conditions for the feature type to exist. In this example, a complex feature type mine is defined as an excavation of the earth for extracting minerals. Two important concepts form the feature type, minerals and extraction. Also, a mine is a complex feature, meaning that the parts of a mine are interrelated for a shared semantic concept. The component features of our mine example are geometric combinations of points, such as buildings, lines, such as railroads, and areas. Other complex features may be just multiples of a similar object. For example, a lot of trees make a woodland. Properties that may create complexity may be temporal, such as the movement of vehicles, or social, such as labor, regulation, and management. When features are interrelated into groups for a central purpose, they form a complex feature type. The scheme of a mind that appears in this example has primitive elements and has secondary or optional components. Typically, complex features depend on resources that extend beyond the limits or boundaries of interest. In addition to their components, complex features connect to broader support systems, such as infrastructure or natural resource systems, such as the hydrology or mineral deposits. Also, all complex features are recognized to appear upon and affect the local landscape of varying extent. The component features and support systems are part of a landscape. This landscape includes references to location systems or ecological regimes or materials that involve the broader locality or region. The interrelation of these three levels of elements, the features, systems, and landscape, build the topography or the environmental context. In the example of a mine, transportation supports the labor and mineral extraction operations of the mine and takes form depending on the landscape, which varies from place to place. Workers may reside adjacent to the mine itself if the mine is an isolated location, or may commute from nearby built-up areas. If developed areas are far from the mine, the transportation may be provided by company bus. Where the mine is located near residential areas, the road system may be able to support privately owned cars, but if not, if the roads are rough, they may be able to manage certain other types of vehicles. There's a whole lot more that I had about the complexity of mines, which I'm not going to read. So to design the ontology, we developed a taxonomy of topographic science consisting of six topography modules: terrain, surface water, ecological regimes, structures, divisions, and events. The objectives of the work that I've described so far are to create a system to support the development of topographic feature ontology patterns for reuse, and to enable those to be linked to other data, similar to the way that relational topographic data is made publicly available. Whoops, I accidentally, let me see if I can go back. Challenges facing a system of this type will be to create ontology patterns so that necessary data can be linked using RDF and OWL, to adhere to RDF and comparable research standards, and building logical reasoning, templates of definitions added for testing. To conclude, the USGS is developing an approach to geosemantic topographic data by converting the free, public, and trusted topographic data already collected and tested for the national map, developing a vocabulary of spatial relation predicates to support environmental activities, using a taxonomy structure that supports inference and generalization, and accounts for three levels of topographic complexity. Our objectives for 2011 are to develop ontologies for open source repository and to focus on gazetteers as the key to user-friendly interface to the data. A number of publications are available on the web that offer more information about any of these topics or stages of our project. First, there's a number of people here who participated in our 2009 workshop, Ontology for the National Map. They submitted papers that have been published in Cartographica, and that issue is now out, so there's five excellent papers, plus an introduction that Lynn and I wrote. We have a book chapter in process that described the topographic data semantics. There's an Autocardo paper that's being reviewed for publication in CAGES on complex features, and a symposium paper examining how topographic data acquire meaning in the practice of science. These publications are all available on our webpage at cgis.usgs.gov, ontology.html, or please talk more with any of us here today if you have questions and comments. Thank you very much.
I think we have time for some questions. Anybody have a question for Dahlia? I do. Maybe it's Lynn or Dahlia, I'm not sure which, but you've talked about making the ontologies available for others to use. Is there any thought that you've given to maybe moving them a little beyond that into the total federal domain for adoption as kind of a baseline for federal agencies to use?
We have been asked to for RDF data, and we had planned to make that available through data.gov, but at this time we haven't really thought about making ontologies participating more widely in the federal sphere with the design of ontologies. We're just not quite there yet, so we will.
I'll put a plug in. I see Mike standing back there. As a former staff director for the Federal Geographic Data Committee and involved in the National Spatial Data Infrastructure, I think maybe these ontologies can be of significant value to NSDI development and activities, as you move forward over time. So, that's a personal plug, I guess, that I would put in.
All right, thank you so much.
Josh?
And if you want software that's supposed to have your company relationship, then going towards standard acceptance of the competitive relationship that you're working on is invaluable. It can be a minimal set, as too far from the show. There's a few operators can go a long way.
The comment was from Josh Lieberman that if we would like to have software to work on those ontologies, the more they get adopted as standard practices or core sets could really go a long way.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd love very much to talk more with you about that. We'd love to implement that.
We do have some off the commercial software that we're trying to use, but I think an open source option would be a better choice. So.
There's a question from the chat room from Gianfranco Givazzo. He had a question on whether you're using any specific taxonomies for the geo objects. And he also wanted to know whether you're considering using something like WordNet to help you, because you're looking at some of these large text descriptions of things.
Yeah, we have looked at WordNet, but we're not using it quite yet. We're still working on those spatial relations that we extracted from sets of geospatial data standards. But it's certainly a very strong linguistic source. We had about a year ago a little prototype for user interface for expanding the feature type terms for voluntary users, for the public. In other words, we had developed a little prototype at one time, and it's on the back burner at this moment, where any user on the internet could enter a term and it would be classified into our topographic feature vocabulary by checking the usability of that term against online dictionaries like Google Definitions or WordNet, and then on the basis of those products, classifying it into an ontology of topographic types. But we will work on that more next year when we get into gazetteers. And the first question was, a taxonomy. We really, at this time, what is working best for us is just simply to have a taxonomy of those six modules that I mentioned, the terrain, the surface water, the ecological regimes, and so forth, because those capture quite a lot that we expect we'll be able to use through the use of inference. And what we really want to work on are the cross relationships outside of the taxonomy. So right now we're just keeping that part really simple.
I just wanted to say a couple of words in terms of a wrap-up of some of the work that we have done. A year ago at the SOCOP workshop, we were asked, I was there, Dahlia was there, several other people, but the USGS was asked to convert some of our data and make it available to the public. And that's the project that Dahlia has just talked about. And what we have done is we have six watersheds spread across the United States in different terrain regimes and different climate regimes. And those six watersheds, the vector data that she showed, all of those have been converted and are available. We also wanted to work with urban areas, so we converted three urban areas, Atlanta, St. Louis, and New Haven, Connecticut, so we had a coastal area. So all of those nine data sets are available in RDF format. We also installed the Sparkle endpoint on our server, and anyone is capable of having access to that server to see us, and we'll provide that access. So those are out there. We agreed to do this last year, and I just wanted to state that we've accomplished that. If it had not been for SOCOP, we probably never would have gone in this direction because we essentially found out that this might be important and something of interest at the meeting last year. So I really appreciate the efforts of SOCOP to encourage us to do this and the help that we've gotten from some of the members in making this conversion. So I encourage you to access those data. Let us know what you think. Are the formats right? Something you can use? Do queries work with them off of the Sparkle endpoint? Those kinds of things. The feedback we need to improve the access to these. And before we convert other data, we want to be sure that these are useful and people can take advantage of them. So we thank you for the work that people have helped us in doing this.
Thanks, Lynn. I bring up the next slide, or next presentation. I'd like to ask Nancy Wiggin to unmute her mic, because she'll be doing the next presentation, and I'll advance the slides for her. But when I gave the introductions, I said that SOCOP is a group of entities that came together on their own, and they're working collaboratively to try to advance semantics and ontologies in the geospatial domain. I guess one of the things that really shows the value of collaboration is this next project. A couple of years ago, the National Science Foundation, through their Office of Cyber Infrastructure, announced an interop grant project, their funding project, and four members of SOCOP got together, Nancy as the principal investigator and four others, James Wilson, Gary Bird Cross, Mike Dean, and Nejan Zhu as co-PIs, and put together a proposal. And the second year of the project, it was funded and awarded, and starting basically now. So Nancy is going to talk about the project, and again, I think it really is a good illustration of the power of people coming together, collaborating, working towards interoperability, and we look forward to seeing this project mature over the next couple of years. So Nancy, you're on. Okay, well, since we have two co-PIs, James or Gary, do you want to start to pick up the ball while we see if we can get Nancy on? Nancy, what we'll do is trying to find the technical person for the room here, and we'll go ahead and get started while we're trying to get that worked out. I'll start with the first slide. Gary said I could talk to that, and I guess I already have to some degree. The Community-Based Data Interoperability Networks, or Interop program, was announced by the Office of Cyber Infrastructure, and it's a cross-cutting program over many directorates. And as I said, SOCOP individuals came together and submitted a proposal and a grant starting now, the fall of 2010, and it runs for 3 years. And it's titled here, as you can see on this next slide. These are the people on the proposal, and Nancy is the PI, and the others that I had mentioned earlier are listed as the co-PIs, and others are listed as participants on the proposal. And others that are interested can work with this study group on the interop proposal as it goes forward, and there's going to be a number of community meetings. And is there, Lynn, is there a solution that we can look for? Gary, you or James want to talk a little more about the next slides, or you want me to keep going? Okay. And you guys can fill in with any additional information. Okay, the idea behind it, again, building on the basic fundamental principles of what SOCOP's trying to do is coordinate with other groups, standards groups such as the OGC, FGDC, which is Federal Geographic Data Committee, for those of you not familiar with it. And how to look for and find out about and touch base with other geospatial domains that are working on semantic issues. And what we want this project to do is to try to be an umbrella over a whole bunch of different domains and to really try to bring the focus on bringing the spatial web and geospatial components into the semantic discussions. Motivation, I think this is very similar to some of the things you heard earlier, what Josh had talked about for some of the OGC work and what Dr. Sheff talked about, some of the motivations. Just the need to try to bring together the many different applications, different types of data, be able to reuse things that are out there much more readily in the future than we have been able to in the past, and to look at where the semantic homogeneity gives us the opportunities for viewing things together, but providing different community views of that data and technologies and capabilities. And again, focus on ontologies and semantics is that piece that plays in moving forward with semantic interoperability in general, overall interoperability in the spatial domain. What does an ontology look like in from a conceptual model? This is something that I think Gary used a couple of years ago in a presentation to the United States Geospatial Intelligence Foundation, NGA Tech Days, that drew upon some work the USGS done in the hydrologic domain. I won't go through and try to explain it.
Actually, Luis Bermuda.
Oh. Okay.
Using USGS hydrological data.
So if you have specific questions about that, ask Luis then. But this is just an example of a conceptual model for an ontology and some of the baseline information that this project will be working from. So the tasks that have been defined for the project, one is to create a geospatial ontology repository. Mike Dean has done quite a bit of work on that and built on the work that Mike has done, to establish some web-based collaboration methods, again, building on some existing capabilities that are out there. Workshops, meetings, some things that are both in-person as well as virtual efforts to bring people together. We talked about tying into some existing meetings such as UCGIS meetings, maybe having as an add-on either before or after or maybe time period during those meetings, opportunities to bring people together, looking at other conferences that take place, building prototypes or demos. And the project, and one of the things NSF really does look at is having an educational component, something where you can diffuse innovation and technology out beyond just people that are working in the community, and that is something that's built in and probably be amplified as we go through the project. And then continuing to bring together and focus on some of the basic research that is ongoing and needed in geospatial data interoperability. This this first time I'm seeing the slides, so I'm reacting to them. This is the OOR community, and as I said, Mike Dean has been leading a lot of the work in that and in the geospatial component, and I think there are some geospatial ontologies already registered in that.
You live in the bottom.
Oh, okay. So Gary is kind of the lead person on pulling that together. If you have ontologies that you want to offer or volunteer to be included in that, see Gary, or if you have questions about it, see Gary or Mike. Collaboration methods. Gary, do you want to talk a little bit about this?
Well, this is a NSF cyber infrastructure project, so there's lots to be thought done here. Essentially, we're looking at ways to have scientists and ontologists, geoscientists and ontologists, cooperate together, collaborate together. The projects, the meetings, the workshops, and so forth reflect that interest. So we have an existing SOCOP wiki site. It's hosted by Sim3. They have an additional, have some collaboration tools. So some of the things you see here in the proto stage are sort of examples of what we'll be using going forward. And of course, I've created a few pages of this. So, as I mentioned, there are ideas of having workshops, bringing together geoscientists and ontologists, ontological engineers, both to educate them about some of the semantics, to make some of their individual scientific data more interoperable and shareable. At the beginning, we're going to be using use cases, try to understand the uses to which shared data might be put, and then we're going to try to formalize those finding semantics to make those more interoperable. There's a listing at the bottom here of workshops which might be co-located with geospatial organizations and groups. So NSGIC, USGIF, and so forth are possible venues for us to be at and work with. And of course, if anybody is out there that has a candidate or wants to participate in those things, we're looking for that. We do need people on both ends. I say we need to have the scientific end, we need to have the ontological end, and we're looking for people to help bridge between those. This is the one that Nancy could perhaps do the best job of. We had a session at AAG on this issue, geospatial semantics and ontology, and there's a list of presenters, including Josh Lieberman, who was there before, as well as Nell, as well as Dahlia. So three of our people here are going to be presenting at this conference. When is the exact timing of that? Okay, in April, maybe April 11th. Okay, so you see this is, again, moving forward with some of these ideas and also presenting it to various communities about what's going to be happening down the road. We're going to have a demo later today from Todd. We've had 3 years of demos and usually incremental demos. Some of them, they start in the spring. They sort of start really at the beginning of the year and have a first initial demo sort of in the spring, something in the summer, and then the fall represents the wrap-up, and so we're going to see the wrap-up of this. We've had demos in the past from BBN Technology, Dave Colas, and Mike Dean, for example. We've had Najun Zhu from University of Maryland, who might be here later, do one last year, and now we have one from Todd Pele, who will be doing it later. So we will be doing that as part of the 3-year project, NSF project. That is to say, generate use cases from that, have some design, capture some ontologies, link things, and over time show interoperability demonstrations between the various sciences. There's also an educational component. Now, James Wilson is here. He's going to be essentially the key person for this. This is the NSF interest in educating the geoscientists on more of the semantics. Of course, we're going to be educated by them in their fields, too. So we'll be producing things. I've started a little bit on that to try to have introductory material on some of these topics. And so over time, we will be hopefully formalizing that, and there will be a product to come out of that that will be a good use educational tool. And the last of the things that we were engaged in is the basic research. And so Nancy has listed here some of the issues. There are many. And I think what you've heard already in the talks earlier this morning give you an idea about some of these issues. And that's why there's a lot of interest from this conference into our work, many ideas being generated and some of the issues to pursue.
you heard about, for example, the query language from Dave on the GeoSparkle, as an example. And Nancy ends with, there is much to do. And I underline, this is a sort of an open, collaborative effort, and we invite other people with their ideas. Actually, we're going to be hearing later today about some of these ideas from Christoph from Penn State on some of these issues that we listed here as basic research.
Well, as I said, this is a workshop, and we need to be flexible, so thank you, Gary. Nancy, sorry that we weren't able to hear you, but if anyone here has questions and would like to find out more about the project, please get in touch with Nancy. And her email address is on the slide, or Gary, James, or I can provide that to you. So let's move to the last item for this morning, and what that is Christoph Janowitz and from Penn State University and Todd Paley from Orbis Technologies are going to do a presentation and a demo. And I guess I'll ask the two of you if we can finish by 12:30. Take a couple of minutes off of your time so that we can get the lunch and turn it over to you.
Okay.
First of all,
I will try to. I'm very bad in staying in one place, but I will try to remind me if I don't. So first of all, thank you very much for inviting me here. And my talk will be also about interoperability as all the talks that... Great, thank you so much.
Does it work?
Okay. So my talk will also be about interoperability, same as the others that we heard before. But I thought that let's start with the first step, namely how do we handle heterogeneity and how we make sure that we don't lose the heterogeneity. And I think you have seen slides like that 1,000 times, and you all know what's on the slide. The reason why I'm showing again the slide saying that geographic information is composed out of a spatial, a temporal, and a semantic component is because this already took us like years to explain that to the semantic web community. But the point here, so the more difficult point is that now that they realize what's going on here, we and also them still keep thinking of, okay, we understand this one, so let's understand this one in an isolated way. But the whole point why I'm showing this is that I think that there's no way to understand what's going on here, that is to create an ontology about the attributive aspect without understanding and incorporating this aspect. So I think they cannot be isolated as represented down here. And I have selected a real-world case study, and I hope you like it, to explain why ontology plays a role here, or in more detail, why ontology cannot play a role in doing that. And I hope you recognize what this is over here. Any ideas? It's a pothole, okay? And maybe it's just a crack, who knows, okay? But I would say that size matters, okay? So you say it's a pothole, for me it's maybe rather a crack because it's not doing any harm to a car, for instance, right? So size matters in this definition, but also location matters, okay? So if this is like on the moon, and there are many of them there, who cares, right? If this is in the middle of the street, then you need to fix it, okay? So we have already started to say that we cannot talk about potholes just by their size and stuff like that, but we essentially need to tell you where they are as part of the ontological definition. Okay, and now what you can see here is like, I don't know where this picture was taken, but looks like a national park or forest, and you see a parking space over here, and you see this big, big, big pothole, and what is surprising is that they have not put like just a tape around that, but like a wooden frame. So this is going to stay for quite a while, right? So there are reasons. Money could be a reason. The location of the pothole could be a reason. But it all contributes to making sure that this is not of danger, and this has also effect on what you perceive as a pothole. And finally, unfortunately, many other things also play a role, like social structure. Again, I'm not the guy who took the picture, so I should not judge whether this is like not the best area, but let's assume it's not the best neighborhood, okay? And what you can see here, I assume that this is from a construction site, and it's also, it has been there for quite a while, and people seem not very happy with it, okay? So this all influences the way how we think about what a pothole is and what makes a crack a pothole, okay? And now let's dive into ontologies of potholes. And these are all real examples, even if they sound very funny, okay? So what you can see here is that in certain parts of the UK, and they have a lot of pothole definitions, a pothole is a crack which has a depth of at least 30 millimeters, okay? In other places in the UK, a pothole is a crack with a width of a dinner plate and the depth of a golf ball. Okay? The same is true for yet another place, but the dinner plate is smaller and it's a fit. And in Coventry, a pothole can be reported to the government if it's a pound coin and a 1p coin side by side. Okay? And the important point here is that these communities have not come up with the different definitions just for the fun of it. Okay? So people don't conceptualize geographic space in different ways because they like to, but because they have good reasons to do so. And one reason in this case is that due to a surf winter last year, there are millions of new potholes, and by state law, the local communities are responsible for keeping the road maintained, and therefore they have to fix the potholes, which is, of course, expensive. And if you would map that, it would turn out that places which allow for, let's say, the big potholes are also the place running, for instance, out of money in terms of local government. Okay? And what you can see here with the letters is that the winter plays a role here in constructing the need for changing the ontologies. Okay? So that's the temporal component. The aspect of the local government, the spatial component, plays a role. And it's also important that this is because they are responsible for whatever is in their administrative boundaries, right? Again, a spatial component. And finally, a thematic component, namely the issue of road maintenance. Okay? And now let's see why we can, in ontologies, only restrict the interpretation in the way we did here. But we cannot fix them, as this would be intended if we would create like an owl ontology of things out here. Okay, so let's revise and keep these definitions in mind. So this is a slide taken from Guarino's famous paper about ontology, and what you can see on the slide is that while we have concepts in our minds, we use certain languages and ontological commitments, that is, things that we believe are true in the world, to come up with the definition of an intended model as a subset of the infinite set of possible models that can be formed, for instance, with natural language. And ontologies are only an approximation of this intended model, which is hidden somewhere in our heads. Okay, I promised you to show some of the consequences. And here we go. Welcome to the wonderful world of potholes, okay? So this is, and that's a picture taken from an earthquake, after an earthquake. According to our definition, this is still a pothole. I would say that if you would ask people what this is, most of them would say it's not a pothole. Or they would be very surprised if they look for potholes in streets to know where to drive, and they would find information about that. But you can still say, maybe we can refine the definition. We can maybe say, okay, we are all humans. We can all think. We can exclude the cases, okay? But keep in mind that the semantic web is essentially about reasoning. So machines will draw certain conclusions based on the ontologies that we give them. And one example of such a conclusion that you can arrive at using reasoners is this wonderful sentence. Constructing bridges is also constructing potholes. And according to our ontologies and simple reasoning, this is true. Okay, so you can only restrict interpretation. And if you're not careful, then you cannot restrict them in the way that things that don't make sense in the domain will still be true in ontology. That's, of course, not new, right? But the important point that I'm trying to make here is that we shouldn't spend too much time on trying to fix meaning, but to restrict meaning and still to acknowledge the local or community-dependent character of meaning. Namely, that people come up with different conceptualizations of geographic space, not by chance, but reasons. And this is from case studies that we did together with students in Europe, and the story is exactly that. So if you have definitions of rivers, and now we are again talking about space, in North Europe, like in Germany, they may be very different from definitions of rivers in the South. So in the South, a river is a river even if there's no water for like 5 years. And the same is true for cultural aspects, right? So that's the cultural point here. If you're living in a country that is most of the part are below sea level, then estuaries have a very different meaning than when they are like sightseeing spots in other places. And the same is here for true for temporal patterns without going into further detail. And now if you think about big data, which is like the biggest hype on the semantic web since 2 years, then what is happening on the big data web, and before I go into details here, I really love linked data. I'm just bringing this up to make sure we know how to put the pieces together and what are the kinds of things that are or may turn out to be difficult. And I like this spaghetti throwing against the wall example because that's exactly what's going on here. So if you look at linked data, then this has the wonderful idea of making information reusable, exchangeable, by just providing raw pieces of data and linking them together. But if you think back to the slides before, to understand what makes a pothole or forest and rivers, then you need the context, right? And the context to find a document web is given by the document. If you open a Wikipedia page and it has a description about, let's say, the term time, right, then you can immediately figure out whether time is used in like a modern physics version because the Wikipedia article is about modern physics, or whether it's just used like to describe a soccer match, for instance, right? Once you isolated this information and just raw chunks of information, simply river, time, soccer, whatever, then it's hard to make sure that they still have the meaning that they were intended to have during the document, right? So there's one article about modern physics which explains time in Wikipedia, but the term time in Wikipedia is used millions of times in a very, very different sense, namely in a naive physical sense, okay? So there's a certain cost at making data accessible on the linked data web, and this is by removing the context, and we hope that we can get the context back using ontologies. But unfortunately, what we do so far is using our same as an equivalent classes. Both are great constructs, and Todd will give a demo about what you can do with them, but we need to make sure that we don't say, oh, you know, this linked data source, for instance, from Amit's group, has a conceptualization of they're doing like weather for, let's say, a blizzard. And there's also the Wikipedia article stored in Wikipedia about blizzards. Great, let's use equivalent class to link it. Okay? There's a high chance that this is going to produce, yeah, in many cases, even wrong results. And the situation is even more difficult with all the same. I'm not going into detail, but we can give you many nice examples. Therefore, what we are trying to do, or what we hope would be the agenda, would be to start at the ontologies and the heterogeneity, and then let the reasoner do the interoperability part. This may sound very familiar, but let me give you like a brief intro into how it differs from what you maybe saw in previous work and also in the talk today. So the vision of the Web 3.0 here is biased. It's like my vision, and it's different from the one Ami just presented, so please don't get confused. What we believe, or what we hope for, is that same as the Web 2.0, the idea of people contributing content, we hope that Web 3.0 will be about people contributing conceptualizations, okay? So that people will become active knowledge engineers. And we want to make sure that communities, and we said that people have different conceptualizations of geographic space in these communities for good reasons. We want to assist communities, like you guys, for instance, and also assist the end users in being active knowledge engineers. Freebase is doing that, for instance, at least to a certain degree. And for this reason, we stopped thinking about this top-level, top-down ecologies for geographic space, because all examples that we saw over the last years, and unfortunately also all the examples that we have created over the last years, turned out to run into exactly this kind of pothole problems, okay? If you try to keep it top-down, you will not only exclude local definitions, but you will have to have such a broad definition that a lot of things will go in there that you don't want to have in there. And keep in mind, reasoning will lead then to possibly wrong answers. What we would like to do is we would focus on the idea of ontology design patterns. Small tokens that can be used by communities and users to create ontologies on their own. So a guideline and tokens to create ontologies, and I will show you one token in a minute. And the second notion that we came up with, so this idea of ontology design patterns is of course not from us, but from Alvin and Gamey. So the second idea that we came up with was semantic signatures. And here the idea was that we want to create the primitives used in the ontologies, not also top, but bottom up, used from real data, from real communities, which have their own sense of local definition, namely from OpenStreetMap, Foursquare, and another Web2.0 social web startup called World. And then, if we have the small local ontologies, we want to be able to combine them and relate them, and this is work that we have just presented at GI Science this year, not only as done so far in the semantic web, and especially in Uha's famous work from the 90s for OpenSci, in microtheories structured using inheritance, that is taxonomy, but we want to use, and think back to this definition of geographic space at the beginning, we don't want to separate them, but we want to structure local ontologies, also called contexts for good reasons, right? We want to structure them using temporal and spatial relations, not only the concepts, but also the local ontology. So we can say, this is the South European local ontology, which therefore is part of the bigger European local ontology, and this will have consequences for the reasons. And finally, the interoperability part between this local ontology is then realized by services such as similarity, so this is what we are working on since several years, and we have demos and servers out there, but also other services like reasoning on defaults, stereotypes, and reasoning with inconsistencies, because this is the case when you put these micro theories together, and we hope to start a collaboration pretty soon with Pascal Hitzler, also from Wright State, James Amit, who is famous for doing exactly that kind of research. And as I promised before, here's one of these ontology design patterns, a more complicated one, but I've chosen this one because we had heard other things about sensors from Luis and Amit, and this is from the same group, namely our W3C incubator group on the semantic sensor web. And our task here was to create a core pattern for the sensor ontology, but the idea was that this pattern can also be reused in many other contexts. And we also aligned it to the Deutsche Upper Ontology. And without going into much detail here, the main idea is it gives you a very, very small amount of classes, so if you take away the Deutsche classes, you just end up with like 4 or 5 relations between them and a description and a guideline how to use them that you can then use for many other ontologies that you want to create. And one example how to use it is the pothole example again. So maybe you have recognized that all these pothole definitions had like a common ground, namely they all were about depressions in the ground, right? Not bumps, not hills, that are in a supporting surface, right? They are not in water. We don't talk about, like, depressions in water as potholes. That impact the movement, but not the movement of cats, but of methods, some sort of vessels, bikes, cars, along a certain path, right? And if you know a bit more about the history of geospatial semantics, then here comes a lot of good news. This is the observation part, so an observable depression, you can measure it, right? So you can use statistical methods and devices to come up with what a depression is, and you can use exactly this design pattern to do that, but supporting surface is an image schema, which is a famous approach from psychology, often used in geospatial semantics work. So this can end up the idea of a surface, right, that we can, that offers support and that we can walk on. This will end up maybe as one of these additional design patterns. Vessel brings in the idea of affordances, also an idea that has been very influential in the past and hopefully also in the future, namely that definitions can only be defined with respect to a certain agent. So it's not a pothole for an animal, but it is a pothole, for instance, for a vessel. So the agent plays a role. This is the notion of affordances. Can also be used to create design patterns. And then we have yet another image schema, namely the idea of such a path. And we also came up, without going into details, with a framework of how to create meaningful URIs, taking into account semantic heterogeneity and still arriving at some meaningful URI for all the linked data that we are going to create using this method. The next step are semantic signatures. We had many names for them before. We started with semantic footprints because we were inspired by gazetteers, then used semantic fingerprints, and finally we now arrived at the name semantic signatures because we like the analogy to remote sensing and spectral signatures. So where's the ontology? If you are a remote sensing guy, like Ola is, do you need to answer the question, what exactly makes a field of crop a field of crop? No. Luckily, these guys simply observe the reflection values, and a field of crop is just what gives you this observation, right? So a certain pattern in, or what creates the spectral pattern in the reflection values of remote sensing device. So that's not the whole story, but that's part of the story. And you can distinguish certain land use types, for instance, based on this spectral signature, and if you cannot do it, like in this case, just looking at the visible band, you can do it by looking, for instance, at the infrared or thermal band. And the same way we think that we want to use numerical models, like models that we can use to understand and have a hill in our data set, or when there is a depression, like we use for potholes, and then come up with such signatures, unique signatures about the semantics, and then use them to reify pattern if you want to see more of the technical stuff. This will go to be implemented as semantic web rule language built in, so there's like no magic hidden behind that. So let's look how things can look like with real examples. This would be like a part of the semantic signature. Again, it's composed of many parts. It's what Christoph Milligan called, who created this figure, a concept variogram based on Olaf's work on semantic variograms. And what you can see here is real OpenStreetMap data from Münster and one in Germany. And I've just taken the public telephone boxes in red over here and there. And schools, I think we also had the schools example in one of the previous talks. And what you, for instance, can see here is that telephone boxes are not similar to other features in these. They seem to be quite unique in nature. They are not semantically similar to many other things, like pubs and nightclubs would be similar. I think these are, for instance, cafes and pubs or something like that over here. And what you can also see is that they are, like, uniformly distributed in space. So Tobler's first law would not apply here, for instance. The opposite is the case, for instance, for the school. And we have a rough first idea why it turns out that schools clump together, and that brings us back, if we have time, why definitions, even such obvious ones, what makes a school, really depends on where they are defined. So we found out that in New York City, for instance, people take single buildings, even each building of a university, as one school. in State College, they use just one big bounding box for the university, and schools are really component of many buildings and really only include schools and not university building, for instance. Okay? So you need to have local semantic signatures for cities or urban areas versus rural areas and stuff like that. And based on the signatures, you can then automatically create your ontology. Yet another visualization of what I just said, namely that let's start this time with the schools. Okay, we see the same schools are more clustered together for some reason, and we just discussed this reason, and you see the more you go into blue, the more dissimilar the bordering things are. And what you can see here, this is the case of the public phone office. They are like, their distribution is like more uniform in Spain. So just to give you a rough impression of the terms in ontology, namely that you can derive terms like uniform or clump to characterize geographic feature types in your ontology and still keep the local signatures. So clump or uniform, saying that telephone stations can be described as uniformly distributed features, may still differ from place to place. And you can do the same with the temporal component. So for instance, steakhouses are evening locations, and this is now based on rural and Foursquare data, and museums are more like afternoon locations, and colleges, and compare that to the beer tag that was assigned by people, are like weekday and beer locations, whatever this is, are tagged from real users, seem to be like more weekend locations. This is only part of the story, but together, each of these components will form a unique semantic signature that we then can use for reasoning and to create the ontologies. And now we are very close to the end of the talk, so let's dive into the second part, namely structuring local ontologies. And if you think here, for instance, about cities or actors or places, then we said that the definitions are local, they depend on context. In this case, for instance, they depend on spatial location. So the theory for Europe includes the theory for South Europe, but South Europe may still be very different in nature. The same is true for temporal relations between them. In ancient knowledge, you want to allow in your ontology that people have two places of birth, right, because that's what you have in your data sources, but in like a modern area ontology, you don't want to allow that anymore. And using this very kind of structuring, we could, for instance, show that the definition of the INSPIRE, which is the European initiative to come up with a combined and unique data scheme, or maybe even ontology for the European Union, defines watercourses as flowing water bodies, and we could demonstrate that using examples like rivers in Spain, rivers in Germany, and stuff like that, that this definition is too strict and will exclude definitions or force people to adopt views on the world that they may not share. And instead of that, we demonstrate using computational models, like in this case, least common human similarity reasoning combined, that based on this local definition and setting some sort of meta rules about the micro theories, we can automatically compute like a compromise, in this case the least common subsumer. So we don't want to create the European definition top-down, but we want to take all the local definitions and automatically arrive at the right, whatever this is, European river definition. And we were able to demonstrate that this works quite good. However, and here you see an example, so the INSPIRE river definition would include the German river, but exclude the Spanish river in contrast to our solution. So while this demonstration worked well so far using similarity and least common subsuma reasoning, it turns out that if you would do that for all countries in Europe, you will have the problem that you will remove nearly all relevant features. There will always be something on what that guys don't agree, okay? So for more realistic or more complex scenarios, we need things like default. 90% of the countries agreed that there is flowing water. So even if Spain doesn't agree, we can still use the flowing water, but using stereotypes and reasoning with inconsistencies, we can still exchange data that is achieved semantic interoperability. And finally, just showing that we have done demos based on exactly that and implementations, especially also on similarity reasoning within such ontologies, for information retrieval, also decision support system, and especially also in supporting people creating such local ontologies, and people can use our similarity server, for instance, to understand whether they agree with an ontology on the web. So you can download an ontology, load it into our tool, and see whether the conceptualization may there match your needs. And I'm not going into any detail here because we have just 1 minute left, but because we have this wonderful OGC presentation today, I just wanted to announce that we have implemented a first release of what we call the Web Reasoning Service, which is able to combine OGC web services with semantic web services by transparently encapsulating semantic web services as OGC service. So the Web Reasoning Service is, in fact, a semantic web reasoner like Pellet, but it's hidden, it's encapsulated inside of the Web Processing Service, and therefore for regular SDI users, it looks like the OGC web. And I leave the conclusions up to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm Todd Paley, Rubis Technologies out of Annapolis. We have been working, as Gary and John mentioned before, on a demo, and this actually comes from the wider side of semantics. This is more linked data. Last year, Dahlia talked about getting USGS data published as linked data, so what could we do? We could set it up in a Sparkle endpoint. But if it's not really connecting to anything, then why are we producing it as RDF? We might as well stand it up as in a WFS or something similar. So I had likeness of sameas.org, decided to create a service called sameplaces.org, which is sort of an informal definition. It's probably more aptly stated as same feature as, and as Christoph talked about, there's lots of issues with linking these things, but basically it's a co-reference manager or repository for linked open data. So as you can see, it's linking locations since 2011, so it's not quite online yet. But so missed some of the talks earlier, but I think we probably discussed the evolution of what I call the web of linked locations. There's lots of geography data sets that are coming online now on linked data. GeoSparkle is coming soon, so this is great. And then, so once we get some Sparkle endpoints that can do GeoSparkle and have other geographic URIs out there that are dereferenceable, what should we do? Well, probably start connecting data. And as Christoph said, we should probably do this carefully, but we also don't want to stifle. You also fear paralysis by overanalysis on some of this stuff. So, and I think we can learn from Web 2.0 and do iterative development. So as things break, we'll fix them. So looking briefly at sort of data set topology and linked open data, how will these data sets connect? You have different domains. Presumably different in domain A, you'll have different connections that will naturally evolve. There'll be some overlap with different domains in domain B. Oh, that's the slide clicker.
Oh, you want to do that?
Yeah, I'm just trying to highlight some of the charts or graphics here. Okay. So what? Well, I think what happened is that you'll have some natural overlap between data sets where they'll connect. We'll know that John is the brother of this guy over here in this other data set. There'll be some same as relations, which maybe correct, maybe not, be some scoffs, close matches, things like that. But we may also want a more centralized approach where it's less amount of knowledge, but it's at least connecting more data so that you don't have to manage quite as much. And that's where same place as comes in. So it'll actually have dereferenceable URIs, which will route you out to different graphs that you can hop to. I call this a graph hopper of sorts. And if the community pitches in, we'll have the intersection. Now, there's lots of issues with this, but I'd rather just start and see where it takes us. So already running behind. So same thing as it's meant to be very simple, linked data service, and it really just manages coreferences. So whenever the Empire State Building and Freebase is mentioned in Site, then we can connect this. How to connect this? I'm waiting for Linked Data Web to tell me. But that is a separate talk for an entire day at least. So I'm sort of being agnostic to this right now. I'm just saying I'm going to connect, and we'll see how the best way to connect is. And so same as that all is out there, but I thought for location-based data, having been able to do spatial queries, so finding nearby URIs that you can then dereference and then hop to those graphs would be useful. Building it on the cloud, trying to make it several different flexible formats for web developers. I want to support named graphs, and this is actually where I'm hoping to capture some of the context and hopefully microtheories that Christoph was thinking about. So presumably you start to get like something like an Empire State Building. What happens when there's 10,000 data sets that reference the Empire State Building? I can't wait for that day, actually. It's going to be a good problem to have, but eventually we will want to contextualize this. So so this slide, how to co-ref, not really sure yet. This is a slide I had at GI Science. I thought it was kind of funny. I found a couple of quotes from quantum mechanics, and I think that the quantum semantic analogs, it's quite relevant. There's a simple GUI. I will skip through this because that's on the video. There's a little API. And I want to get it online and load some data, so I'm going to get to the videos here. And the sync place says video is a little rough. It's there's a lot of triples, so it is meant to be a service much more for machines than humans. Let's see here. But essentially, we want to start adding data to it. So we'll have a graph, a data set that has the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building in New York City. So we also put in some of the assertions, like, hey, this Freebase Empire State Building is the site one. So successfully added the entities. Now a second graph, second user will come in. It has knowledge about Chrysler Building and Empire State Building. And this is where they intersect, and this is what we figure out how to best interact with. Because depending on that predicate, if it's all same as or stuff close match, something like that, it's got different semantics. But so once we start intersecting these graphs that have overlapping features, then we may want to search on one. So I'll take the Empire State Building URI that was uploaded, place it into the GUI here, which, again, this is really almost more for developers. It's supposed to be minimal. So you search on this particular URI for the Empire State Building. On the left, it brings back all the known URIs that it knows about for the Empire State Building. It really has no amount. It has feature types that you can upload, a name. Right now it's just geo.lat.long because that's all the predominant geo vocabularies that are out there right now. And it shows, you know, you can dereference out to DBpedia's Empire State Building and traverse the linked data web. The URI I just clicked on there was actually the same place as URI, so this is a way to get a dump of what it has. So that's sort of the one use case is I have a UI that I found in Linked Data Web. Tell me other graphs I can hop to. Now here's sort of the second use case where I'm in an area and I need to find some nearby features. So tell me, in a, right now it's just bounding box. Tell me some nearby features. Those all have dereferenceable URIs. So if you find one that's across the street from the hotel, it's a bar or something like that, you can then dereference that, and then it'll tell you different graphs you can hop to go aggregate different information. And this is just an example of dereferencing one of those URIs there. So right now it's just minimal amount of data that's loaded in, really. So I'm panning up to New York City. We'll try a bounding box query over there. And looks like I hit on Shea Stadium there up in New York. This is going a little slower than I thought. Okay, so you get on the Empire State Building. And then I want to dereference this resource. So I have a really bare bones just client tool that emulates the linked data client that will do dereferencing. So you can dereference in a number of different formats, just trying to support the linked data publishing best practices. One interesting thing here on the dereference, I try to establish between authoritative and non-authoritative sources, because I'm not an authoritative resource for this. This is an aggregation of knowledge that's out on the web. So it'd be inappropriate, I think, for me to say, here's what the Empire State Building is. All this service is saying is, here's what everybody says the Empire State Building is. So one other thing here is I've dereferenced as NQuads, which I've never seen out on the linked data web. And this is extremely as I aggregate same as assertions or close match assertions across the linked data web, people are going to disagree. There's going to be inconsistencies, and it'll be extremely important that they can take the quad position, the name graph URI, dereference that, find out who said that, and it's just a minimal amount of lineage and provenance information, and you can then take that URI and you reference it out on the linked data web to get more metadata about how that assertion was actually made. So, and I think that's about it. So, what am I doing? Okay, I'm going to keep you guys about 5 minutes past lunchtime. I apologize. So this is the second video is over a linked data browser. And so I took the notion of a linked data browser and thought, well, how would traversing the linked data web be with location data? So I essentially added this flipping map. This tool takes several Sparkle endpoints on the back end. It'll take a URI that you passed in. It'll try to query. It'll go Sparkle Scribe. It'll return it. I took USGS geonames data, and then I took an emulation of the same mass service and added these two data sources. So, this is showing one of the assertions that is in there. So what will be interesting is when we actually query on this is that we'll start with these two endpoints but end up all over the linked data web. So I think this is an amazing showcase of the discovery that you get out in linked data web. Now, it can also be a bad thing, too, because the linked data web is wild and open. So these are engineering tasks that we'll have to tackle in the future. So I take a geonames URI here, hit search. In this case, you'll see these marbles on the left, these little blue icons. There's only one blue icon. That means that it only came out of that USGS Sparkle endpoint that I set up. It tried several others but didn't find any information. As more marbles get aggregated, it's a sign of bottom-up interoperability. It's saying that if you see three marbles, it's saying three different sources said the same thing. So in this mess of data, you can start to get some meaning out of the information that's out there. So I took the USGS URI for the Empire State Building, queried on that. A lot of the data you see there on the left is actually from DBpedia, which wasn't where I started. I only started from my USGS Sparkle endpoint and a SAMAS Sparkle endpoint. So now I'm out aggregating information all over the linked data web. And there you see the multiple marbles. That's saying that three different sources there are labeled at the Empire State Building. As you can see, it's a little rough, too. This is sort of the state of affairs on the linked data web. It's not very well connected just yet. In fact, I get a little bored of always seeing geonames, DBpedia, and sites. I can't wait till there's a lot more data to play with. So here's some of the same assertions, which may or may not be correct, but for now, this is what linked data web is doing. So I took the Freebase URI, and it's a URI that's dereferenceable. You can plug it in the browser, get information from it from Freebase. And, I guess one thing I wanted to point out here is we have the linked data web, the web of linked locations, and then the regular web, the web of documents. And these browsers, I think you'll be able to start to really traverse between all three seamlessly. So scrolling down, you see more and more properties. It's heavily DBpedia, but if you look at those linked data diagram, you'll see why it has a very high node centrality. So, if I can scroll faster. So the purple here is actually the USGS data that I found. I actually found it off of the web. There wasn't a whole lot of attribution, but it does show up here. Not really sure why it says Brooklyn is the map area, but I don't know. That's one of the things, though. It points out a lot of the inconsistencies that's in the data, too. But as a human tool, it's okay in that case, you know. Doing a lot of automated reasoning, yeah, we're going to probably have some issues there. But scrolling a little slower than I thought. I think one of the last things I show is one of the soft subjects of the Empire State Building was skyscrapers in New York City. So I just aggregated some of these in the push bins. It's really arbitrary as to how you'd want thematic attribution to show up, but. So again, you can click from the linked data web into the sort of web of linked locations. Now we're back out into an HTML version of the web of documents. I can also take that URI for skyscrapers in New York and then search it again in the web of linked data. So we'll perform that search. And this time we'll branch out. It's crawling. One of the nice things about the marble slope I'm using underneath the hood is you can set the graph crawl length. So if it only went out one link, if it said Empire State Building, Scott Subjects, skyscrapers in New York City, I would not have the coordinate information for the skyscrapers. So it actually, you can set the crawl length. It's a dangerous variable, actually, because you start going three or more out and you're really starting to explode the knowledge base underneath the hood. So, one of the reasons I'm still using AlphaSAMAS is because the Marbles tool actually has a built-in SAMAS inferencer. I haven't had time to go in and hack it up and make it a SCOS exact match or close match or whatever the linked data web decides is the best approach for these types of co-references. So, And that is it. So, not too bad, 5 minutes.